Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU. This is Siegfried, and it's my first new show in a while. The last new episode of 2021 was the one I did in March for International Women's Day. And, I mean, as I've said before, the pandemic really gets to you psychologically. And there are weeks, even months, when you don't know what to say or feel about the state of the world. It's definitely been a hard... You know, it's been hard for me over the past few months to put my thoughts and feelings into words as the lockdown continues and as neoliberal governments continue to mishandle the COVID pandemic at a terrible cost to working class and oppressed people worldwide. But I finally found my voice, and it's about time because there are some pretty serious matters to discuss. May 15th, 2021 was Nakba Day, the day of catastrophe. When Palestinians mark the anniversary of their violent expulsion from the lands currently occupied by the apartheid state of Israel. Thousands were massacred, while hundreds of thousands were forced to flee for their lives during the Nakba. And even though this genocidal action took place 73 years ago, in 1948, the genocide against the Palestinian people never stopped. And this was the point driven home at the rally I attended in front of Guelph City Hall on the 15th, in which 300 people showed up, masks on, of course, to show their solidarity with Palestine. We marched all around downtown Guelph. And there were marches all around the world that day. I mean, 100,000 people in the streets of London, 10,000 in Washington, D.C., thousands in Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto, all in support of an oppressed people fighting for their lives against a brutal occupation that keeps on killing. Today we're seeing Israeli bombs raining down on Gaza, with upwards of 50 airstrikes taking place within the space of 15 minutes. Today, we're seeing Palestinian citizens of Israel hunted down by Zionist settler lynch mobs, basically, with the full backing of the police and military. We're seeing Palestinian neighborhoods attacked and vandalized. The forcible expulsion of Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque placed under siege by far-right Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs and other racist slogans. As of Sunday, May 16th, 174 Palestinians have been killed in this latest round of violence by an apartheid system that has oppressed them for more than 7 decades. Over 30 of those deaths have been children. This is what settler colonial violence looks like, comrades and friends. The kind of racist lynch mob violence on stolen land that gripped apartheid South Africa in the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, or the Jim Crow apartheid USA during the Red Summer of 1919. You know, the kind of institutional violence that is always under the surface in settler colonial societies like Canada, and is always ready to erupt into open brutality, blatant massacres, and killing sprees. You know, the type of violence exhibited by the Israeli settlers currently attempting to expel Palestinian families in East Jerusalem, you know, forcibly taking over their homes with the full backing of the police and military, I mean, that's more than familiar to indigenous peoples in North America, on Turtle Island. You know, like, I mean, they've faced that, they continue to face that. And the following is a good summary of the Nakba that People's Dispatch put out recently. So I'm going to play that for you right here. It's about 5 minutes. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Hello and welcome to Around the World in 8 minutes, where we bring you stories of working class struggle from across the globe. Over the last week, people across the world have been watching in real time how the Israeli apartheid regime has intensified its colonial violence and relentless attacks on all forms of Palestinian resistance. The aerial bombing of Gaza has already taken the lives of over 119 people, including 31 children, and injured over 900. This bombing campaign is part of a wave of increased assault of Palestinians and their rights, including the placing of barriers at Damascus Gate and the attempt to expel Palestinian families who have been living in the Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem for generations. The attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem and Gaza have sparked massive mobilizations across historic Palestine. These protests in the city of Bat Yam, Jaffa, Acre, Haifa, Lod, and Ramleh have been attacked by Jewish settlers, and Palestinians in those cities have faced retaliatory violent attacks as well. In the city of Lod, far-right settlers have been accompanied by security forces when carrying out anti-Palestinian violence. In several other places inside 48 Palestine, Jewish settlers have entered Arab residential areas and beat up people and vandalized property. In the West Bank, the mass protests against the attacks on Palestinians in Gaza and Jerusalem have also been met with violence from the Israeli occupation forces, So far, at least 11 Palestinians have been killed and over 500 have been injured. Meanwhile, Palestinians living in Lebanon and Jordan have also been mobilizing, and on Friday, May 14th, hundreds attempted to march back to Palestine, but were stopped by security forces at the border. These attacks by the Zionist occupation come on the eve of the 73rd anniversary of the Nakba, or the catastrophe, commemorated on May 15th. The day honors the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forced to flee or were expelled from their homes by the Zionist militias during the establishment of the State of Israel and the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. In the days preceding and following May 15, 1948, Israel's militia, primarily the Haganah, attacked several villages and towns in historic Palestine, massacring and forcing hundreds of thousands into exile in what is now known as Plan Dalet. Some estimates say 15,000 were killed and some 800,000 were forced to flee. The Nakba, planned and organized by the founders of Israel, has caused one of the largest and perhaps longest refugee crises in modern human history. The Palestine Partition Plan, created by the UN General Assembly Resolution 181 in 1947, had already given Zionists more than 55% of the land of historic Palestine, despite the fact that 70% of inhabitants were Palestinian Arabs. The British colonial administration knew that this resolution would be rejected by Palestinians. They used this as an excuse to abandon Palestinians and deliver the land to Zionists, as promised in the 1917 Balfour Declaration. The protagonists of this ethnic cleansing were the Zionist militia, the Haganah, widely considered to be a terrorist organization. One of the key leaders was David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel. Many of the future leaders of Israel were also involved in crafting these plans, including Moshe Dayan, Ariel Sharon, and Yitzhak Rabin. All this planning took place before the unilateral declaration of the State of Israel on May 14, 1948. Soon, all these militia groups became part of the Israeli Defense or Occupation Forces, IDF. Israeli militias and the IDF used the war declared by neighboring Arab countries in 1948 to force even more Palestinians out from areas under their control. By the end of 1948, Israel had control over 73% of all the land of historic Palestine, and the Palestinian Arab population had become a minority within these few months. Most of the Palestinians who were forced out of their homes in 1948 stayed in refugee camps in the nearby cities, mostly in West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, controlled by Jordan and Egypt, respectively. A large number of Palestinians also moved to neighboring Lebanon in the north. The tragedy of the Palestinians already uprooted from their homes, however, continued. In 1967, a second wave of killing and displacement happened when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. Many refugees were forced to go to Jordan and other parts of the Arab world. Palestinian refugees in Lebanon faced yet another massacre by Lebanese militia supported by Israel in Sabra and Shatila in 1982. The Nakba, far from being a singular process ending in 1948, has continued till today. The attacks this week against Palestinians by the Zionist occupation must be understood in this context. The violence is an attempt to further displace Palestinians from Palestine and usurp more land for the Zionist project. While this violence has been a constant, what has also been constant is the heroic resistance of the Palestinian people, whether it be in Gaza, 48 Palestine, the West Bank, or anywhere the 5.6 million Palestinian refugees are across the globe. Throughout the last 73 years, Palestinians have not stopped fighting and resisting the occupation, and their cause has been embraced by anti-imperialists for decades. From Cuba, Vietnam, to China and Angola, the cause for the liberation of Palestine has been at the heart of all anti-colonial and socialist movements. This week, organizations and movements globally have also taken to the streets to express their continued outrage at Israel's crimes and to stand in solidarity with Palestinians. Despite attempts to put out the sparks of resistance, the hope and determination of the Palestinian people is stronger. As the Declaration on Granting Independence to the Colonial Countries and Peoples of the UN General Assembly states, the collapse of the colonial slavery under the pressure of its national liberation movement is inevitable. It is an irresistible and irreversible process.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was People's Dispatch with their recent broadcast on The Nakba Never Ended. That's what that's entitled. Now, Some of you may remember a talk by Michael Parenti that I've played before on the show entitled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes, in which he outlines one of the central cultural themes of settler colonial societies, the theme of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. And this is the paradigm playing out in mainstream Western media, like right now, just as it was in 2014 and 2009 when Israel bombed Gaza. Palestinians are portrayed as unruly savages who fire rockets and engage in violence for no reason, while Israel is depicted as a bastion of civilization with the, quote, right to defend itself. And just like the Hollywood movies that Parenti describes in his talk, in which outnumbered colonizers are portrayed as the good guys holding out against hordes of barbarous natives, this media narrative turns reality on its head. The Palestinians don't have an army. They don't have fighter jets. They don't have nuclear weapons. They don't even have a state. Meanwhile, Israel, a classic Western-style settler colonial state built on stolen Palestinian land in 1948, has one of the most powerful armies in the world, nuclear weapons, and receives billions of dollars in military aid every year from the United States, Canada, the UK, and other Western countries. Out of a population of only 7 million people, more than 600,000 Israelis are active duty soldiers at any given time. And yet the media tries to portray the violent repression directed against Palestinians as a conflict. It's a word they always use, conflict between two roughly equal camps. That's how they try to frame it. And it's ridiculous and it bears no relation to reality. I mean, all this false balancing does is provide propaganda cover for an Israeli apartheid system and the settler colonial occupation of Palestinian land. And perhaps the most blatant example of this happened in 2018 with the Great March of Return, which I did several shows back then concerning the Great March of Return. The Great March of Return saw thousands of unarmed Palestinians in Gaza marching peacefully to the border wall with Israel to protest against the brutal siege and blockade being inflicted on their communities. You know, which of course had deprived them of food, of medicine, you know, of the necessities of life. You know, they can't even rebuild their homes after Israel bombs them. And the Israeli army responded to this peaceful protest with lethal force. Hundreds were killed, including medical personnel. And yet the media still tried to portray this horrific massacre of civilians as a clash. You know, another word they like to use, clash between militant rivals, because some Palestinian youths set some kites on fire and floated them into Israeli airspace. You know, and they tried to make that out as, you know, some sort of clash between like two armed groups, armed factions, you know. Like, it's nonsense. Some of you might remember the shows I did back then when I would read the names of those Palestinians who were killed during those protests, many of them deliberately murdered by Israeli soldiers using 50 caliber sniper rifles equipped with thermal vision scopes for precision targeting. You know, these are not indiscriminate weapons. They're highly discriminate weapons. And the soldiers who fired them knew what the hell they were doing, right? They deliberately targeted Palestinian medics and assassinated them. And it was the same kind of thing on May 15th, 2021, when the Israeli Air Force dropped a precision laser-guided bomb on a residential high-rise in the Al-Shati refugee camp in Gaza, killing 8 children, along with their mothers. I mean, you can't tell Palestinians to be non-violent and lecture them on non-violence after stuff like this. You can't get on a moral high horse and condemn violence on both sides. I mean, Palestinians are resisting apartheid with everything they have, just as black South Africans resisted apartheid with everything they had. And they have a right to do so under international law. You know, the dogmatic liberal myth that the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was nonviolent is a complete distortion of history that erases the heroic struggles of the South African Communist Party, of Chris Hani, Nelson Mandela, the Spear of the Nation, which was the armed wing of the ANC, the African National Congress, which used armed as well as unarmed tactics against a fascistic regime which was terrorizing and murdering, you know, black South Africans en masse. And likewise today, we see Palestinians coming out on the streets to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Sheikh Jarrah, fighting the police of an apartheid state, just like the youths of Soweto did years ago. And we see Palestinians firing rockets and blowing up Israeli oil pipelines outside Tel Aviv, just as the ANC blew up three oil refineries outside Johannesburg in 1980, blanketing the sky with thick black smoke for more than 24 hours, and showing the apartheid state that none of its assets were safe from attack. You know, we're seeing resistance against apartheid, and it is not our place to tell Palestinians how they should resist the system that has been crushing them for more than 70 years. You know, depriving them of their land, of their livelihoods, of their lives in many cases, forcing them into refugee camps, you know, forcing them to go through checkpoints, you know, bombing them, just, you know, the amount of atrocities, displacing them and putting settler colonies on their land. You know, this is, we are not, as settler Canadians, in a position to tell them what to do. Like, full stop. And this is especially true because Canada is among Israel's greatest supporters in the world. Apart from some tepid statements by Jagmeet Singh of the NDP, you know, largely cancelled out by his party's appalling record in supporting Israeli apartheid, you know, and turning a blind eye to, like, massacre after massacre. Besides some tepid words by Jagmeet Singh, no one in the Canadian political class has said a word about the mass murder being carried out against Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Even as multiple American Congress people are issuing statements that are surprisingly critical of Israel and the Biden administration's continued political and military support for Israel. The U.S. has once again blocked a UN resolution condemning Israeli aggression, while Canada has attempted to do the same in the context of multiple UN agencies. You know, I think the Canadian ambassador, like, walked out on several, you know, meetings of, like, the UN Human Rights Agency, like, when it tried to criticize what Israel's doing. You know, so, like, the U.S. and Canada are both providing diplomatic cover for settler colonial violence in a fellow settler colonial state. You know, obviously, there's a, the relationship is pretty deep here. You know, these are settler colonial countries in North America backing up a settler colonial society in the Middle East. You know, which is doing the same kinds of things which, you know, the Canada and the U.S. have done to indigenous people, you know, over the decades and over the centuries. And this continues even though upwards of 80% of Canadians in poll after poll have expressed support for the Palestinian cause. Canadian foreign policy has still not budged an inch. It's not budged an inch. It's still, like, basically in lockstep with Israel on everything, on every issue. And this is going to have to change. And it's only going to change if the mass mobilizations that we saw across Canada on May 15th, you know, it wasn't just in Guelph and Toronto, it was in Montreal, it was in Vancouver, it was in Winnipeg, it was in KW, there's a major, you know, car convoy that happened there. You know, people in cars with Palestinian flags going all along the 401. I mean, it was amazing. But there's only going to be change if those mass mobilizations are sustained and can influence the upcoming federal election in a meaningful way. The present consensus in Canadian politics with regard to Israel, from the Conservatives to the Greens, is absolutely disgusting. You know, because they're all basically parroting the same line. You know, like, Israel has a right to defend itself. You know, making tepid statements about violence on both sides. You know, it's like they basically are backing up everything that Israel does. And they refuse to disengage with Israel or not engage in support for it, doing parliamentary exchanges with it, or expressing, or just, you know, like saying we should boycott Israeli institutions or cut off arms funding. There's none of that coming from like the mainstream parties in this country. So solidarity with Palestine is there in the streets, and it's growing stronger all the time. Not just in Canada, but like in other countries as well. You know, in the US, in the UK, countries throughout Western Europe, all these places which have historically offered rock solid support to Israeli apartheid. You know, the popular opinion is increasingly against those governments and their policies. So solidarity with Palestine is there in the streets. It's growing stronger all the time, and it needs to extend to Parliament as well. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war that is murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Free Palestine.
Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and I'm going to try to be more consistent with putting out new episodes from now on. Next week, I plan to focus on a country sometimes called the Israel of the Americas, and the popular struggles being waged there against another US-supported terror state backed by death squads. Colombia is a country where oppressed people are rising against a neocolonial ruling class that murders indigenous leaders, trade unionists, and human rights defenders on a regular basis. You know, usually without any sort of media outcry or outcry from the international community. Colombia is a country armed to the teeth with American weapons and is home to multiple U.S. military bases. And its right-wing government allows Canadian mining companies to plunder the land with impunity. But the people have had enough, and the current national strike movement is gaining momentum every single day as popular mobilizations continue against rampant and lethal police violence, paramilitary killings of popular leaders, and anti-people neoliberal economic policies. So stay tuned to Back in the USSR for that. That's what I'll be covering next week. But for now, I want to play a clip from the Gray Zone's May 14th live stream in which Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada outlines the current situation in Palestine and explains much better than I can the details of what's been going on. So I'm gonna play that now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
All right, we're live. Thanks everyone for joining. Aaron, you want to kick it off?
Yeah, thanks everyone for tuning in to this Gray Zone live stream on the latest Israeli attack on Gaza. We're joined from Jordan by Ali Abu Nima. He is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, also by Max Blumenthal, founder of the Gray Zone, and Rania Kalik as well, joining us from Breakthrough News. Let me start with you, Ali, in Jordan. Last night, there was another round of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. I just want to hear your thoughts on the latest and the latest massacres.
Well, you know, it's just so depressing to be here again, watching, you know, men, women and children being slaughtered in Gaza once again and in the West Bank. As we're speaking today, it's reported that 10 people have been killed in the West Bank by Israeli occupation forces. And one person in Lebanon is reported to have been killed by Israeli shelling. And so it's such a familiar story. We've seen it before. We saw it in 2014 when Israel slaughtered 2,200 people in Gaza. But I want to take a second to reflect on something that Ahmed Aburtema wrote for us at the Electronic Intifada. Ahmed Aburtema is one of the founders of the Great March of Return, the mass movement in Gaza that was launched in March 2018, which mobilized tens of thousands of people to go to the border unarmed to demonstrate for their rights, where they were mercilessly gunned down by Israeli military snipers. And he wrote an article called "This Time It's Different." And what he's saying is that the spirit in Gaza, people are terrified, of course. They're watching their loved ones be killed. But he talks about, as others do, a strong support for the resistance, that people were demanding that the resistance act. And that spirit is, for the first time in many years, taking place across historic Palestine at the same time. So while Gaza is resisting and fighting for all Palestinians, and that's something that's different, that this war was not sparked by an incident in or around Gaza, but was launched in defense of Jerusalem. And at the same time, we see an uprising across the West Bank. We see Palestinians within Israel rising up, protesting, confronting Israeli police, burning police stations, hoisting the Palestinian flag. And so there's a spirit of unity, of purpose among Palestinians that many have not felt in many years. And I think there's another significant element to this that is that cannot be understated. Less than a year ago, Jared Kushner and the Trump administration brokered the so-called Abraham Accords, where Israel signed these so-called peace deals with U.S.-backed client regimes, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and tacitly, effectively, Saudi Arabia, not yet formally, but for all practical purposes, with Saudi Arabia. And this marriage between, you know, the Zionist apartheid regime and the U.S.-backed Gulf dictatorships was celebrated over what they thought was the dead body of the Palestinian cause. They thought that the Palestinian issue had been buried, that the Palestinians were completely sidelined and powerless, and the you know, the Israelis were victorious. So these Gulf tyrants bet on Israel and bet on Zionism. They thought that was the wave of the future. So this uprising by Palestinians, this resistance, really buries those Gulf tyrants and buries their so-called Abraham Accords and shows that Palestine remains the central issue in the region. And there was also a massive miscalculation on the part of Israel, because emboldened by the so-called Abraham Accords, emboldened by the unconditional support from the Trump-Biden administration. That's what I'm going to call it, the Trump-Biden administration, because there really is no difference. It's just total continuity. They thought that we can now push ahead with the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah in Jerusalem. We can push ahead with the ethnic cleansing in Silwan. We can push ahead with accelerating land theft and settlement construction in the West Bank. And they miscalculated. They did not think that Hamas and the other resistance factions would dare to respond militarily from Gaza to Israel's aggression in Jerusalem. That was a big miscalculation on Israel's part. And I think what we've seen in the last few days, and you can read this from the Israeli analysts, is an element of strategic surprise that Hamas was able to inflict on Israel, where they were able to launch more rockets with more power and more range than ever before, which shows that the Israeli propaganda in 2014, oh, that we dealt Hamas a severe blow, we reduced their capacity, we contained them, is total nonsense. That the resistance has actually got stronger, they have learned from their experience, and they are now able to substantially defeat the Iron Dome, or the Iron Colander, as some people call it, or the Paper Dome missile defense system that Barack Obama was so proud of funding. And we see that tactically and strategically, Hamas and the Palestinian resistance have learned and applied a lot of the lessons that the Lebanese resistance learned in 2006 from its defeat, you know, it's the defeat it inflicted on Israel then. And Israel is now, as we speak, in kind of a quagmire, so to speak. They can't defeat Hamas. They can't really invade Gaza. The only thing they would achieve by that is massacring more men, women, and children. But they're not going to be able to really substantially touch the capabilities of the resistance. And indeed, they would be even more vulnerable if they went in to Gaza for a major ground attack. And yet Israel is looking for some kind of something they can proclaim as a victory, to say, oh, we won, and now we're going home. And they can't do it. Every time Israel launches one of these all-out campaigns of bombing, they end it achieving nothing. And so it breaks the heart, it breaks the spirit to see the death and destruction that Israel is once again knowingly and deliberately inflicting on Palestinians. At the same time, I take strength from the fact that people in Gaza are the ones telling us we know what we signed up for, and we support this fight. We support resistance because it's the only way that we can survive and win our liberation.
Ronnie, I know you have to leave us pretty soon, at least temporarily. So I wanted to ask you for any thoughts you have right now.
I mean, I agree with much of what Ali said. And yes, the destruction that we're witnessing is horrible to see. But, you know, I also have to say there's something inspiring about what I'm watching as well. And I know that's an odd thing to say when Gaza's being so horrifically and relentlessly bombed. We've seen that, you know, that at least 30 children have been killed, if not more, in Gaza in the last few days. And Israel is very blatantly and openly targeting civilian infrastructure. The Gaza Health Ministry says at least 40% of the casualties so far have been women and children. So people should understand this as a bombing campaign against children. That's essentially what's taking place right now. That said, the reason I see something somewhat inspiring taking place right now is I can't remember a time, at least not in recent memory, not in the last decade, where there has been this kind of, you know, you have to give Israel credit for somewhat unifying the region, if not briefly, after the last decade of Arab Spring and all these, you know, dirty wars across the region, with Syria, this escalation with Iran, this sectarian fighting across the Middle East. You know, I've been hearing from a lot of friends across the region, across sectarian lines, and they're all watching what they're seeing in horror. And they've all, you know, they've all unified around the Palestinian cause, at least for now. People from Iraq, people from Syria. I mean, people from, you know, even people I've spoken to who in recent years have started to come along or around to the idea of, well, maybe we should normalize with Israel. You know, maybe it's, you know, maybe the Palestinian fight isn't our fight. But you know what they're watching right now is they're watching a country descending into open racism and violence and lynch mobs in Israel, Israeli Jews running around calling for death to Arabs. And they're seeing what's happening in Jerusalem. They're seeing what's happening in Gaza. They're seeing what's happening in 48 Palestine. And so it was a bit emotional for me in a good way to see there was people in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon today, that tried to cross the border into 48 Palestine, into what people call Israel. There was people, hundreds, thousands of people trying to cross into the West Bank from Jordan, both Jordanians and Palestinian refugees, trying to get in to show their solidarity, to support the people of Gaza, the people of Jerusalem, and you know, the people across 48 Palestine who are being hunted down by Israeli lynch mobs right now. So, it's also interesting. You see the West Bank. I haven't seen mass protests across the West Bank like this in a very, very long time. People in cities across the West Bank are protesting, and they're also dying. Last I saw, at least 10 people had been killed in the West Bank by Israeli forces during these protests. But the point is, people are protesting and rising up. I don't know, you know, how significant it is or how long that will last, but it is something, to say the least. And then the other side of this is, I mean, I'm just watching the Israeli side of things. I mean, I remember 10 years ago, I think it was, maybe longer, before I even knew Max personally, one of the first things I knew about him was he made this video called Feeling the Hate in Jerusalem. And it was this crazy video where he just like interviewed Israelis after Barack Obama had given some speech in Cairo and asked them what they thought about Obama. And just the open, vile, genocidal racism and hate that they showed in that video, which ultimately got censored, was so shocking. But now it's like completely normal. Israel is on, there's the video, but I mean, the Israeli society has become.
Sorry, that's literally the only place you can find that video is on archive. It was banned by YouTube, Vimeo, LiveLeak had it up, and LiveLeak, the entire site went down on May 7th, just as the escalation began. So
that's so wild.
I just uploaded it to Twitter just because it's.
Yeah, that video at the time was the only one of its kind, but I'm surprised it's still banned because since then there's been video after video catching Israelis on camera being proudly racist and proudly genocidal, but it's only gotten worse and it's consumed all of Israeli society. And it's to the point where it just can't even be hidden by American mainstream media anymore. They can't cover it up anymore. All of Israel's nastiness, the settler colonial chauvinistic genocidal ideology at its foundation is in everyone's face right now in these videos that we're seeing go viral on Twitter. I mean, I saw somebody post today, there are Jewish militias in Yaffa checking people's IDs. This is really frightening. This makes me think of, you know, the Lebanese civil war where you had sectarian Christian militias checking people's IDs and then disappearing and torturing and killing people based on their sect. I mean, what's taking place right now, I think, is really unprecedented, really dangerous. And I think it demonstrates how right we've all been all these years warning about just how far down the fascist rabbit hole Israeli society has descended. And, you know, Palestinians are at the mercy of these people. These are the people that are in charge of Israel. They're in charge of the police forces. They're in charge of the military. They're the ones that are carpet bombing Gaza. They're, you know, the Israeli police are giving cover to these right-wing, fascistic, ethno-religious lynch mobs, literally on video, proudly hunting for Arabs to lynch. That's what we're seeing in real time. And so I think that this is a really unprecedented moment in the sense that, you know, even liberal democratic America is horrified by what they're seeing in Israel. I think much like the war in 2014, even if this, you know, escalation winds down in a couple of days, this is going to be one of these turning points that we're going to look back on and think, you know, it really changed Israel's image internationally.
Max, you want to pick up there? You've got to unmute. You got to unmute, though.
Sorry, somebody keeps muting me. It's that little mischievous Ben Norton back there. Well, I'll have a lot more to say, but you know, since Rania's with us and Ali's with us only for a moment, I was on Rania's stream last night on Breakthrough News.
I have to throw in Breakthrough News. Follow us on YouTube, but go on, Max.
It's sort of a generic name for a very special media outlet. It's a kind of a newcomer on the scene. And, you know, if you're not following them on YouTube and you're not watching their streams, you know, you should be. They're, you know, comrades in arms. And yeah, we talked about the theme that Ali was hammering on, which is the improvement of the resistance in Gaza and its ability to really shake the psychological confidence, if not the military confidence of Israel. And one of the questions that I got afterwards from people on Twitter who were watching was, where is Hezbollah in all of this? Are they going to intervene in any way? Obviously, their military capacity is such that Israel has to think twice and thrice and four times before doing anything in Lebanon because they were routed in 2006. And now Hezbollah has offensive capacity after participating in Syria. The 2017 Israeli military analysis conducted by the Defense Ministry determined that Hezbollah in a conflict with Israel would actually be able to momentarily take towns inside northern Israel. And this is probably not something Hezbollah would want to do, but they could really strike a serious blow. I remember at the end of the 2014 assault on Gaza, Hezbollah, I think Hassan Nasrallah issued a statement basically saying they will not let Gaza fall, but there was no chance that Gaza was going to fall and ultimately a ceasefire took place. But where are they here? Is there
I'll quickly before I have to run, and then I'm going to try to come back, but I'll quickly address my take on that, because it's a good question. I don't think that anyone thinks that Gaza is going to fall. I mean, I think people are pretty much of the opinion that Israel is basically trying to reestablish its deterrence, in its own mind at least, by just relentlessly bombing Gaza probably until Sunday. But they want to ultimately end that conflict because they need to focus on what's happening internally, which is much more dangerous to them than what's happening in Gaza, which is this kind of uprising that you have in 48 Palestine, as well as, I mean, the Jewish extremism in the streets, although it's pretty much state sanctioned, they know it's making them look bad. As for Hezbollah, you know, Lebanon is dealing with its own internal economic collapse right now. And that's kind of, you know, at the forefront of every decision being made in Lebanon is that economic collapse. And that's considered something that's existential, not just to the country, but to Hezbollah itself. Hezbollah does not want a war with Israel. The only way they would go to war with Israel right now is if Israel provoked it. As if it was in Lebanon's interest to do so. And right now it just is not, considering the current economic climate. I mean, I live in Lebanon. The situation there is deteriorating by the month. It's literally living month to month. Like every month, you don't know if there's going to be power the next month. There's hyperinflation. Prices are constantly changing. The value of the lira is constantly going down. People are being pushed into extreme poverty in Lebanon. So there's just other issues that are, you know, being prioritized at the moment. Hezbollah's priority right now is trying to, you know, deal with a food stamp program. They've actually launched a food stamp program where they want to be able to make food more affordable for people. They're opening grocery store chains. That's kind of where their priorities lie at the moment. And a war with Israel would absolutely devastate Lebanon. And it would be blamed on Hezbollah. And they understand and recognize that. So unless Israel were to provoke a conflict with Hezbollah, which as you just described, they likely will not do that because Hezbollah can actually hurt them. Unless that happens, I just don't see any situation in which Hezbollah is going to get involved. And I think Hezbollah is watching, and they are watching what's happening in Gaza, and they're impressed with Hamas. They're impressed with the resistance in Gaza. And, you know, Gaza doesn't really need Hezbollah's help right now. The kind of military capacity that the resistance in Gaza has shown over the last 5 days, they have Israelis across the country, all over Israel, not just in the border towns, all over Israel, hiding in bomb shelters right now.
And they've shut down the airport.
Exactly.
I mean, international airlines have canceled flights to Israel. So, you know, it's imposing a major economic and psychological effect on Israel, which Israel cannot withstand for a long period of time.
Yeah, actually in 2014, the airport, Ben Gurion International Airport, which is 15 minutes east of Tel Aviv and Lod, which is a city that's in a state of emergency right now, was shut down for like a day. And this was considered a catastrophe for Israel, a huge embarrassment. It's been shut down all week. This is like a major testament to the capacity building between 2014 and 2021 of the resistance factions in Gaza. And I want to talk a little bit later about the history of those factions. But Ali, Netanyahu convened a meeting with his security chiefs. This means not just, the defense ministry or the Shabak, the General Security Service, Internal Intelligence Service, but also the police, the border police, the militarized police that are really in charge of keeping the Palestinian citizens of Israel under check. A meeting that was unlike any other since October 2000, when then Prime Minister Ehud Barak met with the same principals and said they had a green light to do whatever is necessary to restore order, in his terms. And Netanyahu used the very same language in a press conference, and said, there will be no investigative commission after this. You know, do what you have to do. Haaretz reported yesterday, citing defense officials as sources, that the incursion into Gaza had to basically be stopped, and the assault on Gaza has to be limited because the security situation is so severe inside Israel-Palestine. 13 Palestinians were massacred after Barak had that meeting in 2000. They just shot Palestinian citizens of Israel who were youth, completely unarmed, in Haifa, Nazareth, Umm al-Fahim. This seems like an actually even more serious uprising inside 48 Palestine than in 2000. Is that your view? And you know, where is this leading? I mean, I haven't seen Palestinians, citizens of Israel, shake up the security establishment like this before.
Well, I mean, that reminds me of something. Historically, Israel's military doctrine was always to keep wars short and on the territory of the enemy. And the reason for that is that Israel's army is largely a reserve army. So you have to call up reserves to fight a war. And that means you have to take them out of the economy, which is very, very costly. And so Israel's aim was always to make sure that wars were as short as possible. And what we're talking about now is, you know, potentially a prolonged internal situation, a prolonged situation of internal disorder, anarchy, ungovernability, where they have, it was reported the other day that they were moving 10 units of the so-called border police. This is a paramilitary which is used to violently repress Palestinians in the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem, that they were going to move them to the cities within Israel. So you have to step back and look at the big picture here, that Israel, the Israeli Jewish population, is about 6.5 million people ruling over 6.5 million Palestinians or more, 6.8 million. Palestinians are probably a slight majority. They're probably 52% of the overall population under Israeli rule. So if, you know, Israel can contain the West Bank with the help of the Palestinian Authority, which is what it exists for, and with its troops there. But if Israel has to contain a broad uprising that includes the West Bank and includes the Palestinian population within Israel, and it's fighting, you know, the resistance in Gaza all at the same time, that is probably beyond the economic, social, political, and psychological capacity of Israel to sustain for a very long period of time. Not to mention, you know, that's before we even talk about the further deterioration of Israel's international standing and image and the erosion of support for it around the world, which accelerates with every spasm of Israeli violence and every massacre, every quote-unquote mowing the lawn of Palestinians. Israel has not recovered from 2014 in terms of the damage to its international standing, and it's already sustaining even more damage in 2021. So Israeli society and Israel's military capacity can't withstand fighting on all these fronts. Israel's doctrine was always, as I said, keep wars short and on the enemy's territory, but also a fundamental part of the doctrine is keep everyone divided in order to rule them. You keep Gaza divided from the West Bank. You keep the Palestinians in Israel isolated and divided from the other Palestinians. You keep Lebanon as you know, divided from the rest. But if they're all rising up at the same time, then that doctrine starts to crumble. And I think that's what's reflected in the sense of crisis within the Israeli leadership. And the fact that you've got a population that is in bomb shelters, is terrified, and an economy that's not going to be functioning in this situation. And the mob violence, which Rania referred to, the Jewish settler gangs lynching Palestinians in the streets, I think it's reasonable to, you know, it's somewhat speculative, but there is some evidence for it, because there was actually a video of an Israeli mayor saying, we've got hundreds of settlers coming in from the West Bank and they're going to teach the Arabs a lesson, that Israel is actually deploying gangs of settlers in the cities because they don't have enough forces to deploy to repress everyone at the same time.
Yeah, that's very similar to the right-wing regime of Colombia deploying paramilitaries to supplement the police. And you can see video after video out of Cali showing plainclothes men firing weapons at protesters with a few armored police around them. And this did feel very organized. Netanyahu basically let the dogs out in all the mixed cities to send a message to Palestinian citizens. It's also reminiscent of the early, the kind of preceding days before Operation Protective Edge, this assault on Gaza in 2014, when these Israeli hikers in the West Bank, young settlers, had gone missing. They had been killed by allegedly some Hamas cell there. And the reality was that the Israeli state, the Shin Bet, knew exactly where they were all along, but allowed the anger and just sheer hatred of Israeli society to build, leading these settler gangs and right-wing gangs to rampage through Jerusalem, which led to the burning alive of 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Khader in the Shufat neighborhood of East Jerusalem, which then led to a wider escalation. So I felt that that was deliberate. Netanyahu was milking that as well. There's also a political dimension here where Netanyahu was on the ropes politically and had to let members of Otzma Yehudit, the Kahanists in his coalition, in order just to stay in power. So I mean, to what extent is this also a political calculation by Netanyahu?
Yeah, you know, I was having this discussion with someone the other day that, you know, if you consider like what's in the interests of the Israeli regime, it's not to have Palestinian citizens of Israel rising up and joining, you know, and joining forces and feeling an affinity with Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. You'd want to buy them off by, you know, treating them a little bit better, giving them a little bit more privilege, you know, funding their schools, their clinics, giving them something to lose. But the incentive structure in Israeli politics doesn't reward that. It rewards more and more extremism. And we actually see Israeli politicians, Israeli Jewish Zionist politicians, competing in elections with promises of who can be crueler to the Arabs. And so the internal logic of Zionism is such that it generates more and more resistance, and it generates more unified resistance. And there's nothing within Zionism, there's nothing within the Israeli Jewish political structure that can break that cycle. So I think that that this is the what we're seeing now is a harbinger of what's to come, which will be more and more political breakdown, chaos, and extremist violence that contains warning signs of ethnic cleansing, if not genocide, unless Israel is stopped. So that's the dynamic. And I do think that Netanyahu, you know, what's happened in recent days, I don't like to pay too much attention to the musical chairs of Israel's political parties, but, you know, Naftali Bennett, who is, you know, this just extreme right-wing fascist thug, has now, you know, abandoned coalition talks with the so-called centrists in Israel, who are as right-wing as anyone else, and he's now back in the Netanyahu camp. So politically, this is a net gain for Netanyahu. He gains by burning everything down.